Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Johnston, and along with Susan Leeson, we'll be giving you a brief presentation this morning. Let me introduce, Susan is the former Associate Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. She's also taught law in a variety of schools and locations, and she taught constitutional law at Willamette for a long time. She currently is a person who teaches search and seizure to police officers across the United States, search and seizure law to police officers across the United States. My background is a little more checkered. I have none of her austere credentials, although I've taught law in a variety of places. And 10 years ago, I sat where some of you sit in my first term here. I served as a member of this committee. What we're going to do today is try and give you a dispute resolution overview, a little course on the law in an hour. We're going to break it into five pieces, and Sue Leeson is going to give you the big picture in just a moment. Then I'm going to lay out for you what the options are. Then Sue's going to talk about how those options actually get applied in the real world. And I'm going to turn it back into an indication of what the pyramid of dispute resolution looks like. And finally, there'll be a question and answer period. And the questions that will be in the exam right after the hour are not very difficult. And we think you'll enjoy it. So.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you so much for inviting us here today. My task is to provide a brief overview of the court system in 3 minutes or less. Could seem like 3 hours because it's incredibly complicated, and that's really the point of the presentation. I would like to think of the third branch of government, as the courts are usually called, as a simple place where we have trials, appeals, and final appeal to the Supreme Court. Oh, were that it were that simple, and it is not. Courts in Oregon, and I want to put our primary focus today on Oregon because that's what you're dealing with, but I need to make some references to other jurisdictions in order to do that. Courts in Oregon are called courts of general jurisdiction. In other words, it's presumed that if there is a legal matter that requires judicial resolution, you go to your state court. We also have federal courts in the United States, as you well know. They, by contrast, are courts of limited jurisdiction. You have to plead the right to be there, either by focusing on a federal statute or a federal constitutional provision. These two court systems intersect with one another in sometimes bizarre and strange ways, and we'll get into a couple of examples today. Let's start with Oregon, courts of general jurisdiction. I have handouts that I'm going to be referring to as we go through this. But first, some numbers. And if these are the kinds of things that you find fascinating, the Oregon Judicial Department, Kingsley Click's office, will provide you data that will just numb the mind. I've done some summaries to help, again, paint the big picture. In 2003, for which statistics are now complete, there were approximately 656,000 cases filed in Oregon courts. Now, your first reaction to that number might be, ah, there is proof that we have become an overly litigious society. Let's break down the numbers. 433,000 of those cases were either felonies, misdemeanors, infractions, violations, or extraditions. So the public policy choice to define something as a crime, a felony, a misdemeanor, an infraction, or a violation has an effect on what the courts do. Probably the biggest number of cases going to court are speeding tickets. None of us here, of course, have ever had a speeding ticket, but if you've ever had a friend who's had one, look at it, because at the bottom what you discover is it's really a summons to appear in court. And so it goes into that pot of the 433,000 felonies, misdemeanors, infractions, violations filed in the state of Oregon in 2003. The next biggest category was civil, of which there were about 77,000. And those cases range literally from A to Z, accounting and receiverships to zoning, all matters that have to have some form of court involvement. Next came small claims, 59,000 small claims cases filed in Oregon, followed by domestic relations, everything from divorce to child custody. Juvenile cases constituted 18,000 of the cases filed. And the juvenile cases can range from everything to crimes that they had been committed by an adult but are being adjudicated here, or protective custody for juveniles. And then came probate, about 10,000 probate cases. So if we live, die, marry, or divorce, there's a very good chance that we're going to have some kind of contact with the courts of Oregon. The first chart, if you will, that I handed out explains how we have chosen to organize the courts in Oregon in order to deal with this range of cases. Often this chart, which is put together by the Bureau of National Affairs, typically it's arranged as a pyramid because at the base of the pyramid are the trial courts. Fewer cases filter up to the appellate courts, and even fewer still go to the court of final resort, which is a lawmaking court, the Oregon Supreme Court. But this particular chart is useful, I think, in destroying that image of the pyramid because it reveals that in Oregon we have county courts in many counties, justice courts, and municipal courts, which are handling a huge range of this 655,000 cases I described earlier, with appeal rights to the circuit courts, which are the courts of general jurisdiction, your general trial courts. A few years ago, as is noted in a footnote on this chart, Oregon decided to consolidate the district courts, which were courts of smaller jurisdiction, and the circuit courts, courts of general jurisdiction. So we now have one huge bunch, if you will, of trial courts employing about 166 judges. Parallel structure, we deal with tax in a very specialized way in Oregon. And as you all know, there are also the administrative agencies, which are handling a huge range of cases, which then can be appealed for review to the Court of Appeals. The trial courts are organized geographically, and that leads to the second picture that I handed out, which is Oregon colored by circuit court. This is interesting in a number of respects because it shows us, for example, that not all counties have a court. There are some counties that are essentially consolidated. And as you know, because of the population of Oregon, some of the circuit court areas are going to be geographically small. Others are going to be huge, serving a very diverse population. What I think this chart is useful for showing us is how diverse as well the work is of the judges who are in those courts. Imagine being a circuit court judge in Malheur County, the kinds of issues that you'd run into as opposed to being a circuit court judge in Washington or Multnomah County, the kinds of issues that come up. Now complicate the picture by looking at the fact that Oregon exists. Now we'll turn to the next chart. Oregon is part of another system of government, the United States government, governed by its own constitution, just as we're governed by our constitution. In our system of federalism, which I don't think we can explain to somebody who hasn't grown up with it, I think this is federalism is one of those things you understand because you've lived with it, but trying to explain to somebody where ultimate governing power lies. Is it in your state or is it in the national government? And there's no simple answer. And our judicial system reflects that complication. There are federal trial courts in each of the states, and what this chart is about is the federal courts of appeal, which are organized geographically. In Oregon, we have one court of appeals. We want to avoid the possibility of inconsistencies in the law in Oregon, so we have one court of appeals. Many states organize their courts of appeals geographically and then work out conflicts. The United States is so large that the federal government has decided to organize its courts geographically. We live in this hideously puce color called the Ninth Circuit. Why they would color the largest court of appeals in the country with the most hideous color, I don't know, but I fear it's a commentary of some kind. These courts sit geographically. They are courts of general jurisdiction with an exception. In the law, it seems like there's always an exception. You'll see over here on the far right, it says Fed. In 1982, the Congress created the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, a very specialized court. It consolidated the Court of Claims and the Court of Patent Appeals and areas where Congress said, you know, we just cannot afford to have diversity in the law of this country, even at the Court of Appeals level. Let's get this all worked into one big court. So merit system protections cases, appeals from the Departments of Agriculture and Commerce, patents, copyrights, all those appeals go to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Now, what makes this further complicated is it's very common for the circuits to disagree on the meaning of the law with one another. Let me give you an example because it's an issue that's before the Oregon Supreme Court right now. A few years ago, Congress passed a statute called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act to protect churches and institutionalized persons in their exercise of their religion. Oregon is now confronted with what does RELUPA, as it's called, how does that intersect with Oregon's land use laws? And there is a case in front of the Oregon Supreme Court now asking it to interpret federal law, the meaning of RELUPA, as it affects a zoning decision in a city in Oregon. The Oregon Supreme Court has to interpret federal law. Guess what? The circuits disagree on the meaning of the religious of RELUPA. Eventually, the U.S. Supreme Court may or may not resolve that conflict. The Supreme Court thinks that inter-circuit conflicts, disputes about the law, are a healthy thing. It lets issues work through the process and maybe eventually come to a consensus. Often that doesn't happen. So Oregon law, Oregon courts, is working in the context of a federal system that only complicates an already complicated system. Laws that you enact can sometimes have an impact on federal law, and obviously laws that the United States Congress enacts, like RELUPA, can have a huge impact on the daily lives of us in Oregon. So, overview, very complicated legal landscape. Statutes that you enact can affect who sues, who can be sued, who can be prosecuted for what, and how matters like everything from marriage, divorce, death, and adoption are processed. Brian's going to give us a little bit different perspective, and then we'll come back to seeing how Oregon courts are actually dealing with their 650,000-plus cases.
If any of you are concerned, there's any number of law students who flunked out based on this federalism question, so don't worry about it if it hasn't become crystal clear after Sue's presentation. Sue just gave you a little bit of the context. Now I turn and give you some of the process, okay? So what's coming around is a little chart I want you to look at. I'm going to suggest to you that we could reduce, arguably, the processes that are acceptable in Oregon to four. If you start on the left of that sheet of paper that's labeled 2-12, I took this out of a book that I used on at Pepperdine. If you start on the left, that is not even on the sheet, I'm going to say that that's avoidance. And there's a large number of disputes in Oregon and in every other state in the union that people simply walk away from. Something happened, someone screwed up, someone caused them damage, someone did something, and the others don't want to have anything to do with it. They'd rather just forget it. Okay? So on the left, that is not on my sheet, is the forget it category. On the far right, that is not on the sheet, on the other side, is the self-help remedy. Okay? You cover some of that with criminal law. Okay? And unfortunately, there is far more self-help than there perhaps should be, but self-help leads to all kinds of actions, and it also leads to little things like homicide and war, but we're not covering those either. We're sticking on the four corners of the document today. And on the four corners of the document, I want to briefly walk you through what we have here. I want to suggest to you that the landscape in dispute resolution has changed dramatically in the past 25 years in this nation, dramatically. When Representative McPherson and I were in law school, the concept of arbitration and mediation was largely associated with labor law. And now I'm going to suggest to you in a few moments that it's associated with everything. So although those are very old processes, their use has become much more widespread. Let's start with negotiation on the one side and litigation on the other. This is the way the world looked at it in, say, the 1970s. You had two choices. You could work with people and resolve it, or, to use the vernacular, you could sue the bastards. Okay? Those were your options. And people embraced both of those options. Largely, they tried to work it out. That would be the negotiation arena. Negotiation is simply conducting the business of life. Litigation, on the other hand, is something entirely different. Litigation is the tax-supported method of resolving disputes. It exists in all the courts that we're talking about, that Sue was just talking about. Litigation comes from the Latin root word of litigare. It's a verb. It means to carry. What happens when we engage in litigation is we give our dispute to someone else to carry for us. Now, you might say, excuse me, you don't need a lawyer when you go to court, and that's generally who carries these disputes. And that's true. You don't need a lawyer, or you don't have to have a lawyer, just like I suppose you don't have to have brakes on your car. It's just awfully dumb not to. Okay, lawyers are required, basically, for the pursuit of litigation because law is a foreign language to most of us. In order to prosecute things effectively, you need to know the rules of evidence, you need to know the rules of procedure, you need to know the rules of conduct. It's a very complicated matter. The way this works is simply this. If you were to look at that screen, that's what's available to a judge. There's nothing on it. That's what's available to a trial court judge when the case starts. There's nothing there. If he or she had to make a decision before any evidence was entered, they'd have to decide. They would have to decide for the defendant because the law favors the status quo. It starts that way. Everybody who wants to upset the status quo has a burden of proof. Those burdens vary depending upon what type of case we're concerned with. If it's a civil matter, the burden is preponderance of the evidence, slightly more than the other guy. If it's a matter of who should have the child, it's the best interest of the child. That's a clear and convincing standard. You have to have pretty evidence that's pretty clear and pretty convincing. And if we're going to lock Professor Leeson up for 3 years for armed robbery, we have to have evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. Those are the three burdens that we employ in our Oregon courts. So a moving party, that's whether it be a prosecutor or a plaintiff, a moving party has to write on that screen up there evidence that a reasonable trier of fact, be it judge or jury, could use to conclude that the burden has been met. Okay? So the role of the lawyer is to create a stream of evidence that goes on that little screen up there, so there's something to decide from. Interestingly enough, the role of the other lawyer is to prevent lawyer number one from writing on the screen. So we have what's known as a fight theory of justice. The two lawyers fight, something that's on the screen, and the truth emerges phoenix-like from the dust of the battle. Well, that's the theory. And there are troubles with the theory because, of course, you know, if the glove don't fit, you must acquit. Not all truth emerges from the battle that has just occurred in front of the trier of fact. Very formal process. Takes a long time, even in Oregon. Now, Oregon has some of the best jurisdictions in the nation. But even in Oregon, you're looking at from filing to trial date, you're looking at some delay, whether it be, I suppose, the best jurisdictions now in Oregon are probably 9-10 months, and the worst jurisdictions are probably 21-22 months. Those are pretty good compared to some of the other jurisdictions in the nation. But we got to remember, we haven't filed it the day after this happened. We've delayed, we've done our discovery, and then we've gotten to the filing stage. So it generally takes a long time. So in the 80s, roughly in the 80s, actually the movement started in the late 70s, people started looking for what are the alternatives. And the alternative that came to mind, largely this, we could have a socio-historical argument here, but largely this is the war on drugs, because as Sue suggested a moment ago, the increased criminal filings were taking more and more docket space, more and more space on the calendars of the circuit courts. So without an opportunity to get into trial in a reasonably efficient way, people started looking for alternatives. And courts began the process of doing what was called annexing arbitration. That is, creating a possibility for a litigant to take his or her case and have a arbitrator, whether it be a trial judge or a retired trial judge or a lawyer in the community, take a look at the case and tell them what they thought it was worth. And they connected that, they annexed it to the court system. Let's define arbitration. All arbitration is the selection, if you look on that little sheet there, it's the selection of a third party to make the decision. Okay? It's the consenting adult theory of dispute resolution. If Representative Thatcher and Representative Flores were to agree that Representative Barker is a trustworthy person and they would put their materials in front of Representative Barker and let him make the decision and they would agree to be bound by it, that's arbitration. It's called binding arbitration because they agreed that they would not appeal it. The good thing about it is that would end the dispute. It would be over. Okay? The bad thing about it is if Representative Barker, with all due deference, made an error, And Representative Thatcher was convinced that Representative Barker, you know, misunderstood the law or misunderstood the facts. She'd have nowhere to go because she had agreed that was it. She couldn't take it to court because the courts support arbitration decisions. So back to my story. In the 80s, arbitration became very popular with court systems. It became very popular with judges who were managing the dockets. And they started insisting that things at least take a look at arbitration. You didn't have to step out of line. You didn't have to lose your place waiting for a jury trial, but you had to at least try it. A very interesting consumer-driven phenomena then occurred. The consumer-driven phenomena was that litigants said, oh, that wasn't too bad. You know, maybe we could do a little more of that. And the entrepreneurial spirit stepped in, and private businesses, American Arbitration Association, the Better Business Bureau, an organization out of Orange, California called JAMS, Judicial Arbitration Mediation Service, an organization out of Philadelphia called Adjudicate, stepped in and said, you know, we can provide this service for you outside of the court system. And you can go to an arbitrator and get a decision, and this thing never has to go to court. We can resolve this for you in a matter of months or weeks instead of, you know, the years it might take otherwise. This became very effective. People liked it, with the singular exception that they did not like the fact that you did not have an appeal right. And so people started wondering, how can you, you know, we're starting to design our own process here. What else can we do? And that brings us to the last process that I'm going to talk about this morning. That's mediation. If you look down on my sheet, there's again three people in mediation. There's a middle person, but now it's very different. In mediation, well, I work for my law students, I sometimes define it this way. Imagine a couple married 7-8 years, they've got three kids, and 6 months ago, one husband or wife moved out of the family home. And they admit they're never going to live together as husband and wife. They're trying to co-parent, they're trying to be friends, they're trying to be helpful. And so they make a deal. Friday night, grandparents are going to come over, take the kids, take them out of the family home. The spouse who's out of the family home is going to come back into the family home, and they're going to divide up the things they've accumulated over the years, and one of them is going to file for divorce on Monday. So Friday night rolls around, the grandparents come in, take the kids out. There's a cardboard box on the table with receipts, there's coffee, there's tension in the air. Finally, one spouse turns to the other and says, what would solve this for you? And the other one fights it, loses control, and says, you could die. Very often, what happens? Often the negotiations are over. Off they go to hire two attorneys skilled in the Attila the Hun, rip the lips off the witness school of trial advocacy. Let's take that same couple. Saturday morning, they go to a mediator's office. Same legal pads, same tension in the air, same cardboard box filled with receipts. They sit down, and before the mediator can intervene, one says to the other, what would solve this for you? The other one fights it, loses control, and says, you could die. Very quickly, the mediator would go, that's one option. Turns to the other party, says, what will solve it for you? Guess what they say? That's two options. Then the mediator looks at both of them and says, what other options are there? And they keep talking. That's the difference. The mediator, and here's the sine qua non, the distinction that makes the process. The mediator has no authority to make a decision. Zero. None. Absolutely not. What the mediator has is control of the process. The mediator can decide whether people meet in the same room, can decide whether or not there's an agenda followed, who talks first, all those sorts of things. That's the distinction. Now, so let's just stop for 1 second and take a look at this little four pieces, and join with me for a second. If you start at negotiation and start moving to your right, a party continually loses power. In mediation, they lose power over process. In arbitration, they lose power over process and most of the decision-making authority. They have some in that they can select the decision-maker. If you remember in my example, Representatives Flores and Thatcher were able to select Representative Barker. They move to litigation, and they've lost all control. So there's a continual diminution of power as you move along this process. So one other very, very important distinction that I want to draw for you. The left-hand side, those that are labeled consensual processes, are forward-looking processes. The right-hand side, adjudicative processes, are backward-looking processes. In other words, on the right-hand side, in the adjudicative, they determine what happens next based upon what happened in the past. They have to have a right and wrong. Somebody has to have been right, somebody has to have been wrong. In the left-hand side, they determine what happens next by determining what happens next. That sounds trite, but it's a very important distinction, because what happens is this. If the relationship will survive the resolution of the dispute, and the process you select to resolve the dispute doesn't respect the relationship, you're in trouble. Because even though you get an answer temporarily, you don't have a working relationship that will allow you to go forward. So those are the processes. I would summarize this in one way, though, and this will make sense to you after Sue talks and I get five more minutes. The real process, there's really one in Oregon, and it's called litigation. And we'll be back to it in a second.
Is it all right for me to go to the blackboard, be away from a microphone?
Fine.
What I'd like to do is show you how these processes are now working in Oregon. I think we assume that we've created and funded all these courts, and so they're trying cases, because that's what we see on TV, too. I said earlier that we started out... We start out with approximately 650,000 cases that are filed in trial courts. Well, it turns out that only about 3,300 of those wind up going to the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court in an average year is resolving, I'm saying more or less 100, because it depends on what you count. We count ballot title challenges and so on. But what you're seeing is that these cases are really getting winnowed out dramatically as we move up the pyramid, or we move from the trial court to the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court. So the mystery is, how in the world can these courts be resolving so many cases so that so few go up on appeal and so few require ultimate legal resolution by the Supreme Court? The Supreme Court's function is defined by statute and the Constitution as announcing rules of law. The Court of Appeals' function is to correct errors that may have occurred at the trial level. I think it is just an amazing fact that we go from 655,000 to 3,000 that quickly. So let's talk about how it happens. Thank you, Bill. I hate to reduce you to this. You go to law school, and this is the kind of thing you get to work. We talked earlier about the kinds of cases that we have in Oregon, from civil to domestic relations, the lawyers tend to call this DOMREL or DR, juvenile, criminal, probate, and small claims. The reality is, if all of those cases, which totaled up to 655,000, were to go through full-blown trials, this state would be absolutely paralyzed. And so what we have been seeing over the years are very innovative processes for trying to resolve these cases. So I want to just give you some examples of the kinds of things that are going on. In civil cases, you have provided by statute that if the amount in controversy is $50,000 or less, what's called court annex arbitration is available. In fact, it's mandatory. And as Brian described, what that involves is the court approves a list of arbitrators who the parties can select to resolve their dispute. Now, most of the time there are appeal rights back to the trial court, but they're not exercised all that frequently. The other thing that's going on in the civil context are judges doing what's called settlement work, settlement conferences. I talked to many trial judges who say, you know, I haven't tried a case for months and months and months, but I spend 10 to 12 hours a day in settlement conferences with the parties. Their styles range from true mediation, trying to facilitate the parties to come to a settlement, to put your arm behind your back, twist it till it hurts, now twist it harder, hold it until you're willing to settle. And lawyers are very much aware of the settlement styles that judges around the state have. So settlement conferences are playing a huge role in resolving civil cases. Mediation is being offered in basically every civil case that is filed, which winnows down the number of cases that wind up having to go to trial. Mediation can be successful not only at the trial level. We instituted a program at the Court of Appeals in 1995 to mediate civil cases on appeal as well. We're resolving well over 100 a year now. Parties find that with the help of competent neutrals, they can find ways to resolve their disputes without having to use the resources of the formal judicial system. They like the results better if they own it, and of course it saves us a whole lot of money. So these are the main processes that are being used in the civil context short of going to trial. In domestic relations, mediation is mandatory if there are children involved. Our assumption is, as a matter of public policy, the best thing that can happen to kids is for their parents to agree on matters of custody. Again, often can take very skilled mediators to work with warring couples in order to get them to focus on the best interests of the child. If there are no children involved, some divorce cases are called arbitration eligible. And by court rule, the circuit court, depending on its docket and how many domestic relations cases it's in, will strongly urge the use of arbitration to resolve those cases. In the juvenile context, many counties have a series of specialized courts. The theory being kids are still salvageable, or as Colin Powell is saying in his public service announcement, never give up on kids. We've created specialized courts so that kids are not in the presence of adults, especially in the criminal context. And there are a number of counties called boutique courts developing, family courts that can help resolve juvenile issues, in addition to drug courts and DUI courts and so forth. The other thing that's happening in the juvenile context that I want to point out is that victim-offender mediation is an option offered through the community mediation programs. And I'm a big fan of this one because I do it all the time. I always have cases going. First offender juveniles who meet voluntarily if their victims are willing to meet with them to resolve the conflict. Figure out what happened, and it gives the victim the opportunity to impose the sanction on the juvenile. And you would just be amazed at the things victims come up with that they need from their offenders to make things right. Like, you need to finish high school. You need to get grief counseling. You need to do 50 hours of community service, in addition to paying me my damages. A direct opportunity for the victim to meet directly with the offender. And as Brian was describing litigation, it's really fascinating to watch the offenders involved because they can't turn their dispute over to anybody. I had one young man tell me one day, he said, you know, I've lied to my parents, I lied to my lawyer, I lied to my probation officer. Suddenly I had to sit here in front of the victim and they wouldn't let me lie. Sort of a life-changing experience for this young man. So victim-offender mediation is involved in some range of juvenile cases and has been tremendously successful at very low recidivism rates of cases that are mediated, by the way. In the criminal context, our assumption is that, of course, most criminal cases have to be litigated. Not true. Only about 3% of all the criminal cases filed are litigated. Talk about negotiation in practice. Most are what we know, plea bargain. And that's just a very elegant form of negotiation. It's also important to realize here the incredible discretion that prosecutors have in deciding whether to prosecute and how to prosecute particular behavior. And I know, as a former judge, the same behavior in one county will be prosecuted as one level of crime, and that identical behavior would be prosecuted as a different level of crime in another county, depending on the resources and the political pressures in that county. Plea bargaining plays a huge role in the criminal justice system. And with the advent of Measure 11 sentences, the mandatory sentences for certain crimes, there's a big incentive for defendants to agree to accept lesser charges. For violations, most cases no longer go to court. What the courts have done is put together processes where the parties can stipulate to facts. Some counties are literally using computers to resolve violations and these really low-level offenses. Lots of trials by affidavit, as they're called, in a number of courts throughout the state. In probate, mediation is always offered as an option. Again, so many of the will contests, family disputes, can be resolved with the help of a very skillful third party who refuses to let the parties turn their dispute over to somebody else and just keep doing the naming, blaming game. They have to take ownership of their own behavior. Tons of settlement conferences in the probate context as well. And in small claims, mediation is doing the bulk of the work. Almost all the counties now have mediators who are either volunteers that go through a lot of training or are paid a very nominal sum, and most small claims cases can be successfully resolved. Most of those are forced entry and detainer, landlord-tenant disputes. And by getting the landlord and the tenant to sit down together, a good mediator often can get a resolution that's better for the parties and helps get this number down to a manageable number for what ultimately has to go through the formal legal system. So, bottom line, most of the cases of these 655,000 cases that are filed, we are resolving in ways other than immediately going to trial.
Okay, you've given us almost the entire time. We need 7-8 more minutes to kind of give you a slightly different perception of what your role is, and then we'll take any questions you might have. I want you to, in just a second, I want you to join with me as we create, if I drew a line out to infinity and said, these are life's experiences at the bottom of this little chart, okay? All of our experiences in our lives. Some smaller subset, hopefully very small, but some smaller subset would be the injurious experiences. Things that hurt us as we go through life. Some even smaller subset of that are what we would call perceived injurious experiences. Let me tell you what I mean. Asbestosis, for example, was hurting people for hundreds of years before we figured out what it was, and that somebody knew about it or should have known, and was still using that kind of material, and there might be some liability. So we have injurious experiences, then we drop that number down and we get what I'm calling perceived injurious experiences. We know we're hurt. There's another step above that where only some of those get named. We may not know how we were hurt. We may not know what to call it. But we do know we were hurt. Above that is another subcategory called blaming. You know, this is Representative Smith's fault. And so now I have another decision to make, and that decision is the one I started my discussion with, whether or not to move to the claiming stage. Okay? Now, keep in mind, we have winnowed tremendously from where we started. And now we're up to this claiming stage, and I make the claim, and I tell Representative Leeson that she's responsible, and she tells me to go fly a kite. Okay? I'm still stuck with, I can walk away from this. Or I can file it in, and this takes me to court. And for the first time, we start to have some real numbers now. Because we know of every 100 cases filed in to Oregon trial courts, 3 go to trial. Okay? And now, after the trial, there's the first level of appeals, and I can't even draw mine small enough. Because of those 3, we know that...
It was 3,300 of the 655,000 with the Court of Appeals.
Okay, so we're down to 3,300, and that 3,300 represents about 0.5%. And then of that, we go to 1/100 of that up at the Oregon Supreme Court. What I'm trying to get you to buy into is the cold reality that what you are working at is right here. Maybe you can include the naming stage. But what you are doing is crucially important because it sets the normative behavior and expectations throughout the entire pyramid. You are the market standard. You announce what the rules are. So, for example, if in order to recover from my asbestos claim, I had to give notice 6 months in advance that I intended to file it and I didn't do it, it's over. That's why I say this is really a litigation. We're
you're the Kelley Blue Book of the game. You're not necessarily controlling, but you are rule and norm setting. And so that's why what you're doing here is very important to the courts, of course, very important to litigants, but it's just very important to all of society. It provides the rules by which we will play. So having said that and given you that burden, we're now open to any questions you might have.
Committee members, I think Representative Flores, you had something.
Thank you. I have a couple questions for Judge Leeson. In regard to mediations, they are available at the trial level, and then you indicated that they are also available at the appeal level since 1995. And would you suggest why those at the appeal level did not take advantage of the mediation at the trial level?
You know, often people did, Representative Flores, try it at the trial level. The human realities of litigation are fascinating. At some point, they may just get tired. If it's been years and they've already litigated and other things are going on in their lives and they just want it over, sometimes a skillful mediator can get parties to see interests that they didn't realize they had. I actually did one since I've left the Supreme Court for the Court of Appeals, and I asked if I could just talk to the party privately. And she said, you know what, my lawyer just wasn't listening to me. I never wanted to file this appeal. So we called the lawyer and said, let's talk about the dynamic between you two. And we got that case settled. In other instances, people have found they have things in common they didn't know, and it actually took litigating to find it out. But more and more skillful lawyers and mediators are helping them to see that at the trial level. The Court of Appeals program resolves at least as many cases as one panel at the Court of Appeals could write opinions in a year, so it remains an invaluable tool. And the big categories of settlement are domestic relations, workers' comp, at the Court of Appeals level. And if you ever get bored with what you're doing, just try reading Chapter 656 of the Workers' Comp Statutes and pretend that you're going to write an opinion, and you'll see why mediation is a good thing from the court's perspective.
Second question, if I might, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Also in regard to juvenile court, I found it fascinating, the victim offender mediation process. Excuse me. And where you said there was a low recidivism rate as a result, perhaps, of the offender facing the victim and victim imposing their recommended sentencing. Why could we not utilize a similar approach in not juvenile matters?
Representative Flores, victim offender mediation has been primarily the work of the juvenile courts, but you're correct that there's no reason it can't be used in other contexts. And in fact, I was asked to mediate one adult felony a few years ago because the prosecuting attorney just was not willing to prosecute the case, but also did not want this adult to walk away from the situation. What I'm learning is probation officers and district attorneys know so much. They have literally a nose for which cases should and could be resolved informally and which ones need to be prosecuted. And if we can keep open the door for them to refer out those cases that their noses tell them can be resolved informally, I think it's terrific. And what happens in the victim-offender context is if the parties agree, their agreement is reduced to a contract. That contract is monitored. And what we're finding there is about a 97% compliance rate with the contract. And I think part of that is the psychology. I agreed to it. Nobody told me I had to do it. I now own it. So I think there's great opportunity to expand those programs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have one primary question to make. You mentioned early too about the latitude of the district attorneys to prosecute and that they did so at different levels on the same crime. How does that end up delivering equal justice for the same offense?
Chairman Krieger, I think you've raised a very fine point. It's one that troubled me tremendously as a judge. There are standards that we would look at in terms of the charging protocols in each county. There is so much variation in our legal system, and at some point a person just has to learn to live with that as long as it gets past the threshold of We're not just prosecuting on the basis of race or the basis of age or the basis of gender or the basis of gang affiliation and so on. That discretion is part of the system. It's true throughout the federal courts as well.
It leads to the question of plea bargaining where, you know, you'll get 3.5 and the guy or gal says in their heart feel they're not guilty. But so they, you know, they take that chance, they end up with 7.5. We got a case that we're all aware of, similar to that.
Yes.
That makes people want to look at the sentencing guidelines and these types of things. So having a second look at some time might be appropriate, I think, for us. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excellent presentation, Justice Leeson and Representative. And I think it's a good summary for all of us, even those of us who are more familiar with this. I want to focus on alternative dispute resolution and the prevalence now of contractual contract forms that set out a requirement of arbitration and which are in many cases apparently designed to gain strategic advantage. I'm thinking particularly the securities industry uses these, but they and with respect to the selection of the decision maker and oftentimes the venue for decision making, it's lopsided. And I'm wondering whether the courts try to regulate that sort of conduct, what their reaction to it is when those contracts are brought forward for enforcement. Could you comment on those thoughts?
Representative McPherson, I think you're onto something very, very important for us, because as these processes have become more prevalent, almost all of us who have health insurance have been forced to accept an arbitration provision with our health insurance. Some of them are fair and neutral, and I view that as a question of who do they select as the decision maker primarily, although as Representative Person says, sometimes if we have to go to New York for arbitration, it's not quite fair. There should be some legislation, I think, because this is being treated now on a case-by-case basis. Some courts have thrown out these sorts of things and calling them what are called contracts of adhesion, saying you had to sign it in order to accept. But I think that would be an appropriate place for some legislative action.
I agree.
Thank you.
Representative Broad first, then
Mr. Johnson. In my brief tenure in this legislative body, I have on occasion seen the legislature go directly to the Supreme Court with an issue. I'm just wondering, is that a special privilege that the legislature has in the system?
Yes. We, for example, have taken the supersiding of prisons allowed for an instant appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court. You have that power, and you can craft out exceptions. It's a question as to when and whether it's appropriate to use it.
Thank you.
Representative Ackerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a few observations, particularly with respect to the court-annexed arbitration, and just a minor qualification on, I think, Judge Leeson's presentation, because although there is mandatory arbitration, the statute provides it at the threshold of $25,000 with an option of the local circuit courts to raise it to $50,000. And it gives me a chance to advertise for a bill I will have to that effect to raise the jurisdictional limits for mandatory arbitration to $50,000 from $25,000 across the board. I think there's also a tremendous savings in arbitration to litigants. One of my last arbitration cases, a motor vehicle case, which would have taken a day and a half or 2 days in circuit court, was tried to its conclusion before a court annexed arbitrator in less than 2 hours. Because we have an upfront exchange of documents, we can inform the arbitrator quickly where the issues are. The arbitrator is a lawyer trained in these sorts of things. So there's tremendous savings to litigants. I walked out of that arbitration certainly thinking I had lost because I got out of there so quickly. My second comment would be with respect to the probate section, because we do have a qualification for small estates if they are under $150,000, and that's a tremendous savings, I think, in terms of legal fees and involvement of the court rather than going to a formal proceeding. I have a bill to raise that threshold to $200,000, basically reflecting the inflationary impact upon real estate. My last comment, Mr. Chairman, is thanking the participants for their presentations here this morning, and saying that in many instances, the idea of settlement conferences, the idea of mediation, is something that is, the court system has done for itself without legislative mandate, and I think they should be complimented on that. And I think that these programs are doing a great service to the administration of justice and for judicial efficiency. So I want to thank you for your presentations, because I think the committee might get an idea now that the legal process is quite fluid, but also is self-correcting and can be very efficient. Thank you.
Thank you for the correction, Representative Ackerman. And you're absolutely right. In Marion County, they've chosen the $50,000 limit, and I did misspeak. Thanks.
Any further questions, committee? Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure that there's several cases that mediation just doesn't work, and I'm wondering, is there any evidence where mediation, I guess in small claims or domestic relations, is actually harmful to the process? And for those cases that just don't work, have you found a common denominator in the parties involved or the case brought before the mediator?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, the biggest criticism against mediation and many jurisdictions have ruled it inappropriate for situations in which one spouse has battered the other. It's any power imbalance question. There's a whole body of literature, probably best represented by a woman named Trina Grillo, who says that women tend not to do as well at mediation because they tend to be more cooperative than men generally.
That's hard to believe. Any further comments, questions? I appreciate you very much coming. At one point, I was going to order oxygen for you, though, because you were getting a lot out quick. You look like you're out of breath. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to close the informational part of our hearing and open some work sessions. We'll start out with House Bill 2051. I believe Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, Representative Thatcher is the carrier of this bill. It clarifies that the Oregon Youth Authority, not the Department of Human Resources, certifies a youth offender foster homes. This bill comes to you from the Oregon Youth Authority.
This bill was well discussed in the subcommittee. Someone like to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2051 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Flores moves House Bill 2051 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussions? Objections? Okay, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2051 is moved to the floor. It has passed.
Mr. Chair, I was going to ask who the carrier was, but...
Yeah, well, I can... You want me to do this before you hit the gavel afterwards? Doesn't make any difference. All right, I'll do them afterwards, okay. Then. Representative Thatcher, do you want to carry it to the floor, too?
Sure.
Okay. She'll be our carrier. The next bill, we're going to go drop down to 2261. Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Representative Gerard is a carrier of this bill, and this bill is affectionately referred to as the Scrivener's Bill, and it makes tweaks and changes to Oregon's and current laws. It's a very important bill for legislative council's office to pass early because it helps them in drafting the rest of the bills through session. It changes grammatical errors. It removes out-of-date references in the ORS. And as I said, it's an important bill to them to have passed through the system early.
Okay. Any further comments?
Mr. Chair, question.
Flores Thatcher? I mean, Flores?
That would be Flores.
Yes,
I know we
hey,
look
both
so
blonde.
Much alike. Yeah, I understand. Okay, we don't have to have that discussion. is this the bill that did have some question regarding the conflict of the verbiage doctor versus physician?
It is the bill, and the parties have got together, and they've agreed to get it taken care of over in the Senate.
Thank you.
They're both satisfied with it.
Mr. Chair, are you ready for a motion?
I am.
I would move House Bill 2261 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard has moved House Bill 2261 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Seeing none, you want to call a roll, please?
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
House Bill 2261 has moved to the floor with the due pass. Was it Representative Garrard that was supposed to carry that?
That's correct.
Want to carry it to the floor then, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Now we're going to go down to the second bill, 2185, and Heidi Moed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This House Bill 2185, Representative Barker is our carrier. This bill comes to us from the Governor's Task Force for Driving Under the Influence of Intoxicant Crimes. What this does is changes the law so that an individual who, upon a second arrest for driving under the influence of intoxicants, if they refuse to take a breath test, they must now wait 90 days to obtain a hardship permit. Under current law, they only have to wait 30 days. This is an opportunity to encourage an individual to submit to a breath test if they are a repeat offender.
Okay. Someone like to make a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I move House Bill 2185 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative McPherson moves House Bill 2185 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further comments, questions? Call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative
Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
And Representative Barker, want to carry it? Yes. Does pass. Thank you. Now we're going to drop down to 2323. Heidi Moed again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2323 comes to us from the Parole Board. This changes the law. Currently, a dangerous offender has to be evaluated by a psychiatrist or psychologist 60 days prior to their parole hearing. When it interplays with a second statute in the same chapter, the Parole Board must set a hearing within 60 days. That has been interpreted by the courts to mean that both the psychological evaluation and the hearing all must occur within a 60-day period. This, by clarifying, gives a 120-day window for the examiner to examine, make a full report, provide it to the parole board, and allow the parole board to give it its due consideration prior to the dangerous offender's hearing. This bill, by the way, was carried here today by Representative Thatcher. A note, this has minimal fiscal impact, but according to the Legislative Fiscal Office, because the 60-day window has been an area of some litigation, by expanding this to 120 days, although there is a minimal expenditure impact statement issued with this bill, it's actually going to save the general fund approximately $7,000.
Thank you. Have a motion on the bill?
Chair. I move House Bill 2323 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Thatcher has moved House Bill 2323 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions or objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
House Bill 2323 is moved to the floor with a due pass, to the floor. Representative Thatcher, would you carry the bill, please?
Yes.
We're going to go back up now to 2256. Mr. Sears?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2256 is brought to us by Legislative Council. Carrier is Representative Girard. House Bill 2256 is a relatively simple change. It's not meant to be substantive, and it just sets out what provisions, it identifies provisions to which certain definitions to apply regarding chattel mortgages.
Have a motion on the bill. Representative Girard.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House Bill 2256 be moved to the consent calendar.
Any objections? Okay, do we need to vote on that bill then to close the consent calendar?
Chairman of the committee, I'm not sure. I can go check.
Unanimous consent.
Yeah, unanimous consent.
We have to vote unanimous.
Yeah, let's go ahead and vote to find out. Go ahead and call the roll.
Representative Atkins?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chairman Person?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Okay, House Bill 2256 will move to be moved to the consent calendar. Do you want to carry that bill on the floor? Representative Girard, I shouldn't call you bill here, should I? The next bill we're going to go to is 2286. Mr. Sears.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2286 requires that sheriffs accept cashier's checks and teller's checks from purchasers at execution sales. Currently, they're not required to accept those checks. Instead, money has to be deposited at execution sales. And this tends to limit the people who can purchase property at these sales, which ultimately tends to limit the price at these sales. Carrier of this bill is Representative Ackerman.
Okay, do we have a motion? Representative Ackerman?
Yes, so Mr. Chairman, I'll move House Bill 2286 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves House Bill 2286 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any questions or objections? Okay, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Bill passes. Would you carry the bill, too, Mr. Ackerman?
Representative I will. Ackerman? Thank you.
Okay, now we'll go to 2287. Mr. Sears?
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 2287. Authorizes debtors, trustees in bankruptcy or the attorneys representing either to file a notice of bankruptcy in the deed of records of the county, and it also deletes some obsolete references to the National Bankruptcy Act, which was passed quite a long time ago, so it refers to federal bankruptcy laws. It clarifies judgments and orders of the bankruptcy court that may be recorded in the real property records must be certified by the bankruptcy court rather than the district court clerk. It takes quite a bit of time to file these with the district court clerk, and it's much easier to do with the bankruptcy court clerk. Furthermore, filing the notice of bankruptcy provides more information to everybody, all the parties involved, and it's a much more streamlined process.
Have a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2287 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative McPherson moves House Bill 2287 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any questions or objections? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Flores, would you carry it on the floor, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Now we'll go to 2290.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 2290 is being carried by Representative Flores. This bill extends the time for filing accountings by personal representatives and conservators from 30 to 60 days. Apparently, there's a problem with being able to get all the documents that are needed to file these accountings, specifically bank records that are now required. And so it just extends this time limit so that the court's times aren't taken up by extending the time limit on motion.
Okay. I have a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2290 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Flores moves House Bill 2290 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions or objections? Not to call the roll, please.
Representative Askew?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Bill's moved to the floor. And would you also carry it, please? The last one we have today is House Bill 2291.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 2291 is being carried by Representative Garrard. And this bill includes trustees to the list who may bring actions under ORS 124-100. That's a statute that gives a cause of action for abuse of an elderly or incapacitated person. Excuse me. Currently, there are four class of people that can bring these actions: the elderly person himself, incapacitated person, guardians, and personal representatives of estates. This bill will include trustees to that list. Oftentimes, trustees are in the best position to bring this action because they know the trustor, the person who made the trust, and so this bill would just include those people to that list.
I have a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2290.
Excuse me a minute. Did you have a concern? There was no public testimony. Were you here for the bill when it was here before?
No.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2291 be forwarded to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barker has moved House Bill 2291 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any concerns or objections? I have a note here I'd like to see, please. Any objections? Could you call the roll, please?
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2291 is moved to the floor. And Representative Garrard, would you carry it, please?
I will, Mr. Chair.
That completes our work for today, and we're adjourned.